WFAE streaming is sponsored by Corporate Information Technologies, a local IT company assisting business and taking a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. During the Great Recession, we started inviting Dr. John Connaughton to share his quarterly forecast of the state of the economy with us as a way of getting our bearings. Well, Dr. Connaughton is director of the Babson Capital UNC Charlotte Economic Forecast, the state's official forecast, and it's that time again. He's back with his numbers, and we'll try to make some sense of them. Charlotte also just wrapped up what was arguably the biggest event in its modern history, the Democratic National Convention, so we thought we'd take a few minutes to see if we can gauge the economic impact of that event on the city and what it may portend for the future. Since it's obvious we can pull off a high-profile event in the glare of the national spotlight, what's next? What can we do for a second act? You can hear the gears turning down at City Hall already. For some words of wisdom on that, we've also invited the Charlotte Observer's Steve Harrison to join us. We'll talk to him a little bit later in the program, but good morning to you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And John, welcome back.
Thank you, Mike.
Good to see you. This election will most likely be about the economy, and the big question asked of people going into the DNC was, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? If we leave the politics out of that question, are we?
Well, 4 years ago, we were heading into probably the worst recession we've had since the Great Depression. There's no question about it. It started in September of 2008. Actually, the recession started in December of 2007, but the second shoe fall and the real hammer, if you will, where we started shedding jobs like crazy began in 2008. And there was very little that we could do to get in front of that. And so I don't know where you take the starting point in terms of what happened. But if you look at and just say, in September of 2008 versus September of 2012, are you better off? The answer is probably not. But if you take what was taking place during that period of time for the next 18 months, which was the recession, which we couldn't stop, and so it was going to happen, the answer is, yeah, we're better off today than we were in the depths of that recession. And I know that's not answering your question, yes or no, but it depends on the take and whether or not you say that the results of the recession were inevitable.
And of course, that leads to the next question, which is politically laden, and that is, would we have been worse off without the auto bailouts, without the
stimulus package.
The stimulus package. Would we have been worse off? Would we have been in the same place? Would we be better off having not done this?
Well, I think the auto bailout question is some ways doesn't matter in this, because ultimately GM, Chrysler would have existed regardless of how we went through bankruptcy, whether it was a government-orchestrated bankruptcy, which is what we did with some government money, to basically not help GM and Chrysler as much as help some of their suppliers and their unions, so that they didn't take the big hit that they would have taken through a bankruptcy procedure. At the end of the day, however, GM would have emerged, as would have Chrysler, and so there's probably little difference. It's just who won, who lost in that well, probably would have changed. But as far as the stimulus is concerned, I think the stimulus was helpful in stopping the slide. I don't think there's any question about that. Could it have been designed better, not just to stop the slide, but to try to push some things forward? Yes. But it is politics, and it's Washington, and you're never going to get a perfect result.
And a lot of people were upset because they saw their taxpayers go into these massive multi-hundred-billion-dollar bailouts, and they thought, well, there's my money going down the rat hole. Yesterday, I think it was announced that the government is selling its stock in AIG. They are the big boogeyman, one of the big boogeymen in all of this. And the government has the controlling share of interest in that company now because of the bailout. They're selling that stock, and they're set to make lots of money as a result.
That's correct. And they also did with the bank bailout. There was about $240 billion that went to U.S. banks in late 8 and 2009. And the government's probably made so far. They're still short. Some of the small banks haven't paid back, so there's almost $1 billion out in outstanding TARP money to banks. But the banks that have paid back to 239 billion of the 240 billion. They've made about 19 billion on that. The taxpayers of the United States have made about 19 billion. But when you ask the Treasury what happened to that profit and what happened to those that money that was returned, they'll simply tell you it was put into the supporting the national debt on other purchases of things that we have no idea what they did with it.
When President Clinton was in Charlotte last week, he had some things to say. And among them was...
That's a surprise, Mike. I would have guessed.
Well, among them was, no president, not me or any of my predecessors, no one could have repaired all the damage he found, meaning President Obama, in just 4 years. But he has laid the foundation for a new, modern, successful economy of shared prosperity. And if you renew the president's contract, you will feel it. You will feel it. That is a quote. Do you agree with either part of that statement?
Well, there are two parts of that. The first part is most likely true. This was a serious financial collapse. We've had these before in this country. Not recently, not in anybody's memory per se that's around today, but we've had these before. And they do take a long, long time to repair. And the reason that they do take a long time to repair is that it affects consumers, businesses, banks, and even government psychic. It changes the way we behave and the way we respond to incentives and signals. And so Clinton's right in that respect. No one could have repaired this in a simple 4 years. If you remember, Mike, when we went into this and we had no idea who the next president was going to be and we didn't know what he was going to do, most of us, the economists that you interviewed at that point in time, told you this was going to be a 6 or 7 year ordeal event. This was not going to be an in and out kind of a recession and recovery. That having been said, as far as going forward, that's, I guess, for the American voters to decide in terms of whose vision going forward will get the economy moving quicker, faster, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. And to that, I'll let everyone be their own judge, and I think they will be come November.
And, of course, the big bugaboo in all this, and particularly in North Carolina, has been jobs, and the lack of jobs, the high unemployment numbers.
As bad as the job picture has been nationally, which has gained a lot of attention in this political cycle, where we're talking about where are the jobs, how many jobs have been lost, et cetera, it's actually considerably worse in North Carolina. Nationally, we lost 8.7 million jobs. We've gained back a little over 4 million jobs. About 46% is what we've gained back in terms of the percentage of the jobs we lost gained back as measured by the BLS. In North Carolina, that record is far worse. We lost 333,000. We've gained back 106,000. We're in the low 30% range.
And we've talked about
way
this.
Off.
We've talked about this before, but for those who weren't listening before, why are we worse off? Are we lagging the national?
Let me finish with how bad off we are so everybody gets a picture of this. In addition to the fact that we have only gotten back 106,000 of the 333,000 jobs lost, we have a higher unemployment rate than the nation. So instead of 8.1%, which is the national rate, we're at 9.7. When this all began, by the way, we had an unemployment rate that was less than the United States. And within a year, our unemployment rate exceeded the U.S.'s, and it's been somewhere between 1.5% and 2% higher, per percentage points higher than the U.S. rate for the last 3 years. Secondly, North Carolina has consistently for the last 2 or 3 years been amongst the top 5 states in terms of the unemployment rate. And right now, the latest figures for states is July. We are 5th worst unemployment rate of the 50 states.
Why?
And part of the reason for that is that the structure of this state's economy going in was susceptible to the big hit that this recession generated. Number one, historically, even though manufacturing employment has become less and less important in the state's economy over time, as it has nationally, we still have one of the highest percentages of our labor force engaged in manufacturing of any state in the nation. Us, Rhode Island, Michigan. Well, it used to be Michigan, not so much anymore. So that's number one. Number two, because we were a rapid growing economy over the past 3 decades, we have a very high percentage of our labor force engaged in construction. And so we had two sectors that had a little more importance in our economy than the average state would have. You then create a financial collapse, which means that businesses and consumers can't borrow money. And when you can't borrow money, you can't buy manufactured goods and you can't buy houses. And so as a result of that, or you don't invest in commercial real estate, et cetera. And as a result of that, those two sectors took an enormous hit. So the 333,000 jobs we lost, two-thirds of them we lost in manufacturing and construction, and we both know that those jobs aren't coming back. Some manufacturing jobs have come back, but not anywhere near the 100-plus thousand that we lost in this recession, and none of the construction jobs are really coming back at all, and probably those aren't coming back for quite some number of years. Then you throw the third kind of wild card in on that, and that is that we had developed, particularly in Charlotte, a very large banking center, and with the financial industry taking an impact, although it was short-lived in the sense that, you know, employment in the state's back about where it was when this all began, the financial services industry, it still has taken a pretty good hit during that downturn, and that's part of the reason why.
I want to get back to this, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago, and bring it down to the local level, because a friend of mine yesterday said, I want you to ask Dr. Connaughton this question. She said, my real estate value is much lower than it was in 2007, 2008. My salary is down. My income is down about 25% from that time. But my net worth is way up, meaning that 401ks and other stock investments in the stock market have gone way up. So am I better off or am I worse off?
I think that's an individual question in terms of how their portfolio, particularly for net worth, how their portfolio was structured and the kinds of decisions that they made when the market collapsed in late 2008 and really crashed, if you will, and got down. The Dow got down from a high prior to the recession of over 13,000 and change to, what was it, 6,600 it got down to at one point. And so it depends on what you did. Obviously, if you bailed out at the low point or on the way down and you didn't get back in, you probably didn't do so well on that. But, you know, in both instances, what your 401 says on paper, what the value of your house says when the assessor comes by and appraises it, are paper values. They aren't realized. And we have to remember that in terms of, you know, at different points in time, they're worth differently. But I would say in general, Mike, that that the average American citizen is probably not as well off and certainly is not as optimistic today as they were in the summer of 2008 before this thing began. Okay. Now, they're probably better off, and they're probably a little more optimistic than they were in the depths of this thing in late 2009, early 2010, when this when the bottom was clearly visible.
Okay. These forecasts that you put out every 3 months, the North Carolina Economic Forecast, are partially a look back and then partially a look forward to what may be coming. When you look back at the beginning of the year or at the first forecast that you designed to look at 2012, has it turned out to be what you thought it was going
Absolutely
to be?
Absolutely not. And in the beginning of this year, we were very optimistic. And when I was on here in March, we were basically talking about, you know, 2012 being a better year than 2011 and leading to a potentially a pretty good year in 2013, that we might actually start to see a 3% growth rate in 2013. But between that time and today, a number of things have happened which have not been positive in terms of what's taking place with the economy. Number one, Europe turned out to be a lot worse than what I think anyone expected. When we started to move past the Greek problem and started to hit Italy and Spain, and they started to become engaged, and some of the European countries all of a sudden started to become obstacles to any type of progress in terms of trying to solve those problems, what it essentially did was to send Europe into a recession. And over the next couple of months, quarter, and actually over the next two quarters, much of Europe, many of the 17 EU countries are now in recession. Those that aren't in recession are likely to be in recession before the end of this year. So with our largest trading partner, which is the EU, in recession, that is going to take a hit, if you will, out of the U.S. economy.
And what that means is we can't sell to them because they can't buy.
That's exactly right. And when you look at countries like Spain with an over 25% rate of unemployment, Italy with 10% rate of unemployment, Greece with a 23% rate of unemployment, France with over 10% rate of unemployment. This is serious business.
Dr. John Connaughton, the director of the Babson Capital UNC Charlotte Economic Forecast. We'll get into some more numbers as we go through the program. And Steve Harrison is here, quietly waiting in the background, reporter for the Charlotte Observer, to talk about the economic impact of the DNC. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Invisible Fence Brand, committed to keeping pets safe at home with customized pet protection solutions now for any size property from zero lot lines to large acreage. Details at InvisibleFence.com. And the Center for Environmental Farming Systems NC10% campaign, committed to building a sustainable local food economy through support of local food producers, businesses, and communities. NC10%.com. Uptown Charlotte has its share of museums like the Mint, the Beckler, the Gant Center, and the NASCAR Hall of Fame, but there are a couple of museums in suburban Charlotte that you might not know much about. I don't. The Armed Forces Museum and Archives of the Carolinas is in Mint Hill, and of course the Carolinas Aviation Museum, which features the Miracle on the Hudson jet, is near the airport. We're going to spend some time talking about what both have to offer tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Chicago teachers on strike, how the unions fight over merit pay and job security, highlights a broader national struggle.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon right after Charlotte Talks, here on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Dr. John Connaughton, director of the UNC Charlotte Babson Capital Economic Forecast, and Steve Harrison, a reporter for the Charlotte Observer. I promise you, Steve, we're going to talk about the impact of the DNC here in a minute or two. I think he's getting a little antsy over here. I'm worried about him. You don't see any quickening of the pace of growth or change in the North Carolina economy anytime soon, do you?
No, not anytime soon. As I said, we've got a number of things that are problematic going forward. Certainly, we've had the increased impact that the European recession is going to have on this country in the remainder of 2012 and into 2013, because their recovery is not going to be particularly fast. And they've had the terrible, dastardly double dip, if you will. Second thing is, we saw gas prices rise this summer, and we've talked about this before in the show. That's never a good thing. It takes money out of consumer pockets. We've probably taken somewhere, in the terms of gas price rise during the summer, we've probably taken somewhere between $40 and $50 billion out of consumers' pockets that they could spend on other things, and we shipped a good portion of that out of the country. And then we've got this big thing that's hanging over us, which could tip a meager growth year of 2013 into a double dip, and that is the Bush-era tax cuts. Now, without getting terribly political about this in terms of how those should be extended, the problem we've got is that, number one, the Social Security tax holiday that we've all experienced, where 2% of the Social Security tax has been not collected for the last 2 years, that is going to go away January 1st. And that means that Americans are going to take home about $90 billion less cash in 2013 than they did in 2012. That's going to happen. There seems to be no sentiment to continue that holiday on. Number two, if the Bush tax cuts do not get passed in some form, all right, and they just simply expire, there'll be about another $110 or $15 billion that will be taken out of Americans' pockets because of the marginal tax bracket rates increasing. So, for example, the 25% that many people pay will go up to 28%. There's a little 10% donut right now for the first $8,800. That'll go to 15%. That's $440 and everybody that pays taxes right there. And the rates all the way through the spectrum, there are six rates, and they all go up between 2 and 3%. That's another $110 to $115 billion. The third piece is sort of the hidden piece that most people aren't aware of, and that's something called the AMT patch. It's called the Alternative Minimum Tax. I don't have time to go through it on the show, but that was originally not indexed when it was passed 20-some years ago, and it had crept in by the early 2000s into many middle Americans. It's designed to make sure that because of high levels of deductions and exemptions that richer people weren't paying their fair share of taxes, and so this was put in, never indexed, and it crept down in terms of who it was affected. If the Bush tax cuts aren't passed, that ATM indexing goes away, and all of a sudden people who have never experienced that are all of a sudden going to see that crop up again. That's another $125 billion. So all totaled, if you do the arithmetic, I think that was a popular phrase in Charlotte recently, potentially $330 billion will be taken out of Americans' take-home pay.
How big a pay cut is that?
That's 2% of GDP. 2% of GDP.
But as an employee making a salary?
It varies by state. The analysis, in some of the lower-income states like Mississippi, the average decrease in people's income, take-home pay will be about like $2,500. In some high-income states like New York and Connecticut, it will be close to $6,000.
And is it meeting or
here,
exceeding?
We're in the middle, about a little over $3,000 in North Carolina.
Does that meet or exceed the inflation rate?
Oh, clearly exceeds. And when you take $300 billion out of Americans' pockets, that's taking 2% out of GDP. And if you're only forecasting 1.5% to 2% growth as it currently stands, mm-hmm. you'd, again, do the arithmetic.
Well,
it's gone.
That means you really can't do it if you want to stay out of recession, right?
And I think about 2 or 3 weeks ago, Ben Bernanke, testifying before Congress, essentially said that. He's the Fed chair, and he sat in front of Congress and said that if those tax cuts are not passed in some form, then we will probably – the Fed is predicting recession in 2013.
But then there's the other part that we're facing at the end of the year. The U.S. is said to be poised on the edge of a financial cliff, that if we go over the cliff, if the Congress and president don't act to avoid it by the end of the year. So given how close to the edge we got with the vote on raising the debt ceiling, do you think we will or can avoid this cliff? And what's the impact of not avoiding it?
You know, I don't know how – I don't know how the political system's going to play out right now. We've certainly, for the last year and a half, we've been through this before with the debt ceiling back in the summer of 2011, and we went right to the cliff. If you read Bob Woodward's current book, he'll tell you the Treasury Secretary said that we were $5 billion. In one day we had $5 billion in the U.S. Treasury, and it's tough to run the U.S. government on $5 billion when it's $3 trillion budget. So, you know, that's problematic, and I don't know what the politicians are going to do and when one of them is going to say uncle and they're going to come to some kind of agreement.
How do these two things figure in? The sunset of the Bush tax cuts, unless they renew them or renew some form of them, and this fiscal cliff. How do you accomplish both? How do you keep us out of recession by refunding the Bush tax cuts and not sending us over the cliff?
Well, I think the issue is there are two aspects of this. There's a short-term aspect of it, which is if you raise taxes by that much at this point in time, I'm pretty sure that 95-98% of economists would suggest that you will probably put the country in recession. So that's probably not a really good idea. But I think that you need to come up with a long-term package to deal with the deficit so that in the out years, like for example, right now, if you look at the OMB estimates for through 2017 or 18, the best we get in terms of the current deficit is somewhere in the 650 to 700 billion range. So we basically, you know, 5 or 6 years out, we cut the deficit in half of what it is now. It's still too big a deficit. We need to get the deficit under a $450-500 billion at that point in time. So you need a short-term, I guess you could say, stimulus in terms of making sure that Americans still have the take-home pay to spend, but you need a long-term program that is consistent and says to the markets and the financial community that we've got a plan we won't back down on, and it will deal with spending and taxes going forward.
I was actually surprised to hear you say earlier in this conversation that your forecast is more pessimistic than past forecasts have been, because when I read your forecast, I honed in on the paragraph that said 10 of the state's 14 non-agricultural sectors of the economy are expected to experience employment increases during 2013.
Mm-hmm.
This is a forecast now.
That's right.
The coming years. The sectors with the strongest employment increases next year are non-durable goods, manufacturing, 3.2%, hospitality and leisure services at 3%, and retail trade at 2.8%. And by all things I've read, retail is booming. I mean, Belk Stores reported record sales a couple of months ago. So did Macy's, I think. So why aren't these an indication that we're doing pretty well?
They're modest increases, and we still have other sectors that are not going to increase employment and not going to increase output. A couple of things here. Number one is that what we're seeing right now, when you look at U.S. productivity rates, that's sensibly output per worker hour, they have become stagnant in the last 5 quarters. And normally an economist would say, oh boy, that's trouble. No productivity growth, that's not a good thing. But right now, that's probably not a bad thing in the short term, because what that means is if you're going to accommodate any growth in sales at all, you're going to have to hire labor to do it. You're not going to be able to rely on substituting capital for labor because productivity is stagnant. So there's no productivity gains to be made. The only way you're going to increase output is to increase labor, and that's what we're really seeing in 2013. So it's, you know, again, if the Bush tax cuts get passed in some form, and I'm not suggesting they get passed all, you know, without some sub, you know, it doesn't matter whether Obama gets a tax on over $250,000 or not. That's such a small part of the dollars that it really has very little impact. If they get passed on in some form or another, then we will see probably 1.5 to 2% growth in 2013.
Let me ask you, does it matter who wins the election in November? All this stuff has to happen by the end of the year. So if Obama is reelected, you've got one scenario. And if the Congress stays, the balance of the Congress stays similar to what it is now, you've got that scenario. Then you've got the scenario of Mitt Romney winning the election, perhaps Republicans gaining more seats in Congress. Does that change the probable outcome of both the renewal of the Bush tax cuts and or falling off the fiscal cliff?
Okay, let's get one thing straight. Right now, Once the election is over, there will probably be some type of positive bump in the economy because right now what we're observing are there's so much uncertainty in terms of what 2013 will look like in terms of who's president and who controls the Congress that – and if you're the average business fan, you say man or woman, you say, look, if Romney wins, I'm going to do A. If Obama wins, I'm going to do B. But in the meantime, I'm not going to do
anything,
either A or B. And as a result of that, you're not making a decision. Now, we can argue as to whether or not A or B is going to have a bigger impact, but I think it's fairly clear that either A or B will have a positive impact. So once this political season is over, this is a big election in the United States. And a lot hinges on it. We probably don't have time to go into in this show, but it really does have a lot to do with the future direction of the economy and the country. Once that decision is made, others will start to make decisions to accommodate the direction the country they perceive the country will go, and the economy will begin to pick up.
Jason on Facebook writes, my wife and I run a small business, and we're as busy as we can be. We often work 7 days a week to keep up. It seems to us that the GOP is holding the nation's economy hostage by refusing to do what economists say is needed to help us get out of the slump. Pass the jobs bill and make the rich pay their fair share. What's your reaction to that?
He gets the vote in November.
Yeah, so you're going to be cagey on your reaction too. Okay. Steve Harrison is with us. He's a reporter for the Charlotte Observer. We're going to come back to the economic forecast in a moment or two here. But arguably the Democratic National Convention, it was the biggest, most prestigious event ever to hit Charlotte. You wrote in the Observer, Steve, that it was the crowning achievement of the city's two-decade quest to become a world-class convention destination. It takes money to compete in the convention business, and Charlotte has certainly spent its share over the years. How much do we spend on an average year attracting convention business to town?
You know, probably about $30 million a year, and that pays for the construction debt on the convention center. It pays for the operating losses that the building incurs. It also pays for basically subsidies that the city has to give groups to come, whether it's like the National Rifle Association or the Shriners. We have to basically pay their rent. We have to give them other incentives because there's so much competition to get this business that in the convention business, you have to open your checkbook to get people to show up.
Everywhere in the country.
Pretty much. I mean, I think some of the top destinations, the top cities like a Boston or a San Francisco, you know, they have a little more leverage because people want to come there.
Yeah.
But when you're a city like Charlotte, you know, you're kind of going after this kind of lower, less prestigious convention. And
yet we just got one of the most prestigious conventions any city can get. The two political conventions are the biggie. Are the biggest.
That's right.
So having done this, having done it fairly well with fairly good reviews from people except about hotels, which we'll get into, does this lessen the need to spend money to attract future conventions? Because it was good enough for the Democrats. It's good enough for the XYZ company to come here and have their convention.
That's going to be interesting to see in the next year or two, because I think what you're going to see happen, and there's already been some talk about this, is that what Charlotte needs is a bigger hotel. And this is what some people are saying, that that the Westin has 700 rooms. That was subsidized. And so there's this kind of rumbling, this murmuring that we need a 1,000-room hotel and that it would be subsidized by taxpayers. And so I think you're probably going to hear something about that in the next year or two, with the idea that the DNC put us on the map and this will now take us to a higher place.
Well, you wrote an article recently that said in the last several years, groups and associations have told convention and visitors bureaus across the country that they want to see 1,000-room hotels near convention centers to make it easier for all of their delegates to be under one roof. Without getting too political here, that sounds like it's right down the alley of certain boosters in town. Let's build this 1,000-room hotel. And when you said that the Westin was subsidized, what does that mean for those who don't know?
Back in, I think the Westin opened in 2004. And so when that opened, the city put in paid for about 10% of the construction costs on the building. Today, what you're seeing in a lot of cities when cities do 1,000-room hotels is that there's a much higher investment. You know, some cities have spent up to half. Some cities have built them entirely themselves. And so I think that
– and then just lease it to the company that runs it, like a Westin or a Marriott or whoever.
That's right. That's right. And so I think that if Charlotte goes this route, I think they're going to probably end up, you know, paying for much more than 10% of this big hotel. You know, I think it's just hard. You just don't see a lot of non-subsidized hotels that big.
Has the Westin turned out to be – it's 700 rooms, and it's right next to the convention center. Has it turned out to be a good investment for the city if we subsidized it, since we did? I mean, has it turned out to be a good thing?
I think it kind of goes two ways to look at that. It hasn't increased the amount of business at the Charlotte Convention Center. If you look back at it over 10 years – the amount of hotel room nights from the convention center attendance, it hasn't really changed. So the Westin didn't do what it was supposed to do. Now, on the other side, you can make an argument that the hotel is here and the hotel was kind of an asset that could be used to get the DNC or things in the future or – you know, you could also make an argument that just building the Westin, having this big shiny skyscraper, makes the city look like it's big time. You've got this fancy hotel. So, you know, if you look at it just purely from an example of what it was supposed to do and what it's done over the last 10 years, probably not.
And maybe you can jump in here, too, as an economist. But if you build a 1,000-room hotel – and we already have a 700-room hotel, not to mention the other hotels that are already down here, whether they're great 4-star hotels or 5-star hotels or flop houses. If you have a 700-room hotel that you can't fill and you add 1,000 rooms to it, what does that do?
I think you have more rooms that you can't fill on a regular basis. Clearly what we've seen is, as a result of recession, is less travel, and as a result of that, ideas that may have worked in a different economic environment don't seem to be panning out right now. So, you know, that's a possibility. And so if we were to be looking at building a 1,000-room hotel, I think we'd certainly have to be fairly certain that the economy was in better health and that we were going to start to see a lot more in the way of conventions and convention visitors coming to the town.
Plus, if we build a 1,000-room hotel in Charlotte, North Carolina, home of the Democratic National Convention, if we do that, won't other similar-sized cities also do that just to stay competitive with Charlotte? And
that's
then
right.
We're back at ground zero.
Yeah,
right?
It's an arms race. I mean, you know, everyone will have a 1,000-room hotel, and then kind of there'll be a next phase, which will be, you know, cities are already in the convention business kind of building like little entertainment centers next to their convention centers. Mm-hmm. So, right, you know, if you pay a group money to come, and you're the first one to do that, you get a competitive advantage for a year or two, and then everyone else catches on, and you're right back to where you started. So,
Steve Harrison's with us. He's from the Charlotte Observer. We're going to talk about the Democratic National Convention and its economic impact as far as we know it today in a moment or two. And then Dr. John Connaughton will wrap up our discussion of the economic forecast that he puts out quarterly for the state and for Babson Capital. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Charlotte Symphony. Christopher Warren Green conducts the classics season, opening with an all-Beethoven program featuring pianist Arnaldo Cohen, September 21st and 22nd in the Belk Theater. Tickets at 704-972-2000. And St. Andrew's Sewanee School, a progressive boarding and day school in Sewanee, Tennessee, offering intellectual challenge and personal attention. Accepting applications for enrollment. SASWeb.org. Chicago teachers are on strike. How the nation's fight over merit pay and job security highlights a broader national struggle. That's the topic at 10 of the Guy and Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, now would be the time. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online, WFAE.org, and then click on Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Hi, I'm Ray Suarez, inviting you to join me for America Abroad, Sunday evening at 7 on 90.7 WFAE. Our reporters keep you informed in an increasingly global world. From the economy to a changing Middle East, we bring you in-depth reports on the critical international issues of our time. That's America Abroad, Sunday evening at 7 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Dr. John Connaughton, director of the Babson Capital UNC Charlotte Economic Forecast, and Steve Harrison, a reporter for the Charlotte Observer. We're talking right now about the Democratic National Convention's economic impact on Charlotte. And we were talking just before the break about hotels and the need for hotel rooms, one of the things that's clearly coming out of the Democratic Convention. And one of the things that we didn't serve up so well were hotel rooms. Even the hotel rooms that we have at our disposal are maybe not what delegates from certain areas of the country were expecting, certainly at the price they paid. But you just can't build a bunch of four-star hotels with 1,000 rooms or thousands of rooms to handle a convention that comes around once in a lifetime. We may get the RNC in the future. We may get a return of the DNC, but there are no guarantees. So if we want, but if we want to handle future events like this, do we have to have these things? Don't the reviews indicate that we have to have these things?
I think probably the next, what you're hearing now in the city, that the next thing they like to do, I mean, first, like you said, the RNC is a possibility. Now you're hearing a lot of talk about the Super Bowl. The NFL historically has had a rule that they won't play a Super Bowl in an open stadium in February. You know, you have to, they wouldn't play it in Charlotte. It's too cold. They recently awarded the Super Bowl to New York City. So that's kind of, got everyone excited.
They set the precedent.
They set the precedent that they'll do it. So Jacksonville hosted the Super Bowl a few years ago. They didn't have enough hotel rooms. And I think they, like, brought in some cruise ships and put them on the river.
We can do it.
Exactly. We're going to have a problem with that scenario. So I imagine the Super Bowl is going to be kind of used as a carrot, or at least this is why we should do this.
But then again, I think you wrote about this, or somebody wrote about this. If the Super Bowl comes here, we're going to be hit up for improvements to the stadium because, and this came as a shock to me, our stadium is old. It was built in 1995. That means old. Does that mean we'll be soon hearing requests from the Panthers either for a new stadium or for significant upgrades so that they can attract something like the Super Bowl?
I think, I think what'll happen is there. A couple years ago, the Panthers made some kind of feelers or outreach to the city about, you know, possible assistance, and it didn't really go anywhere. But I think what's going to happen is my guess will be a pitch for a big renovation, probably not a new stadium, but. And what the NFL does is when – and, of course, in today's environment, the public has to pay for a big part of that. And so what the NFL does is it's kind of an enticement for taxpayers to go along. They hold out the Super Bowl as a possibility. You know, if you pony up, $100 million or $150 million, then, you know, we might give you the big game.
The Panthers own the stadium, correct?
That's right.
And they control the stadium,
mm-hmm.
correct? Refresh my memory as to why communities are asked to help private enterprise. Is this a public-private partnership, John? Is that what this would be technically?
Technically, that's what it would be. But, you know, in U.S. sports is very, very much unlike European professional sports, where they have relegation. And therefore, you know, clubs can go up and go down from the Premier Division. Here, the 32, is it 32 in the NFL, Steve?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, 32 NFL owners basically have a monopoly, and they have the right to move that club anywhere they want to move it. And so that creates a different dynamic.
I know that you've done economic impact studies in various places across the country about the impact of arenas and stadia and things like that on local communities. Would that be a good investment for us, knowing what you know about other places in the past, all things being equal?
Well, one of the things is that if you build a new stadium for a team that doesn't exist and the team comes, it does typically have a significant economic impact. If you build a stadium to keep a team from moving, you've blocked the loss of an economic impact. But when you build a new stadium or build a refurbished stadium for a team that is not leaving and is already here, the impact is minimal because all you're doing is looking at what the additional revenue is from that stadium as a result of the improvements.
Is the Dallas Cowboys story a case in point?
Probably, yeah.
Because they moved where? From one place to another in the same neighborhood?
In the same metro area, that's right.
Okay. Yeah. One of the things that we haven't talked about that has been floated as an idea of how do you top this? Don't laugh at this. We made fun of this in Charlotte Squawks, but it turns out to be true. Somebody's thinking about bringing the Olympics here. Not the Winter Olympics, but the Summer Olympics. Although we might build a mountain and put snow on it. Who knows? To do that, that would be, for a city this size, an unbelievable investment, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and it's I guess the earliest they could do it would be 2024. 2020 is going to be awarded in a couple years. Back this summer when the city council was considering, you know, helping pay for the Knights baseball stadium uptown, I started hearing that from city council, like, oh, this will be help us, you know, with the Olympics, and you kind of drop your pen a little bit and, you know, ask them to repeat that. But it was already kind of the buzz was there, and so, you know, I think we'll be hearing more about that.
What do we know about the impact of Olympics on cities? There's a lot of talk about whether or not it's going to help London, whether or not these cities recoup their investments.
Well, there are a number of folks who suggest that the Greek problems stem from their hosting the Olympics several years ago. So, you know, the Olympics are expensive to host. There's no question. There are a lot of new facilities. And the biggest issue is whether or not you can get private money to help in the construction of the facility improvements that need to be made, new facilities and improvements. Yeah. And, you know, Charlotte's got some facilities ready to go and ready to, you know, we've got two Coliseums of reasonable size. That helps. But we probably – and we've got the UNC Charlotte arena that would also help. So we've got a lot of venues already in place. But there would have to be a lot of things built, a lot of special facilities. And if you can't get private donations to do it, it can get right expensive.
And I think one problem, you know, in when Atlanta hosted 1996, they had this, you know, very a huge privately supported Olympics. So they had corporate sponsors. They had ads everywhere because they kind of wanted to keep the government out of it. So the Olympics was so covered with sponsorships that the IOC hated it. I mean, that was, I think, the first Olympics
seriously, too bad for them.
Well, but what I'm saying is that's going to make it hard for Charlotte. You know, Charlotte is a little Atlanta, and so I think that's going to be difficult for the city to kind of get past that and if they want to do it.
Well, a coalition of government and nonprofit agencies has hired Tourism Economics, Inc., part of a London-based Oxford Economics, to analyze the DNC and its impact on Charlotte. That report is due out in November. So let's just take a look at what we know so far and what was prognosticated out of this before this program ends today. Organizers of these national conventions always tout the windfalls that they bring to host cities. City officials in New York and Boston claimed economic impacts of $255 million and $156 million, respectively, for the 2004 Republican and Democratic conventions. But according to a report by the Department of Economics at the College of Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts, their examination of 18 national political conventions from 72 to 2004 suggest that these rosy economic projections are overstated and these events have a negligible impact on local economies. What are we likely to see out of the Democratic convention here, and what do we know that we have achieved at this point in time? Anything?
I think that in some ways it went better than people thought because, you know, in Tampa there was a lot of complaints that the security was so great that downtown businesses just couldn't interact with conventioneers. And here I think there were so few protesters that College Street and Tryon Street were pretty much open for business. And so I think that went, you know, it gave people a way to spend money, and I think that went about as well as it people could have envisioned. I think that, you know, kind of at the end of the day, we can rewind this a little bit and go back and look at sales tax receipts for the month of September and kind of see, you know, is there a change? Is there a noticeable change? Did it go down? Did it go up? And so I think that'll give us a pretty good indication of how this fit into the overall economy.
This report that I just quoted from the College of Holy Cross report was released in 2008, I think. That was before. Was that before we got this convention?
Yeah, we got it in February 2011.
Do you think that Charlotte officials looked at this report before they got it? Or is this one of those things of, yeah, it's going to have economic impact. It could be a wash, but it's going to probably have some impact. But more importantly, it's going to put us on the map, and you can't buy that kind of impact.
It's tough. You know, if you look at that last week and you see all the major news networks, even primetime networks and their morning news, evening news, and their 1 hour of coverage late at night. You know,
don't forget the Daily Show now.
And don't forget the Daily Show. You know, they were all broadcasting live from Charlotte, and for the most part, had good things to say about the city and good things to say about the convention. I think at the end of the day, if you pull one of these things off positively, and I think Charlotte did, it can have long-lasting impact in terms of people's perceptions of the city, whether they may come here at some point in time and do a visit. You know, how do we measure that? We can't measure that.
We have all these infrastructure pieces that we've talked a lot about over the past years, the light rail system, the NASCAR Hall of Fame, the football stadium, the museums, the civic, the arena, the U.S. National Whitewater Center, the convention center itself. All of these were used in some form or fashion for the Democratic National Convention by its delegates, etc. Does such an event finally put a positive spin on the desire to build these and the actualization of building these events, of these pieces of infrastructure that were so hotly contested at the time of their being proposed and built?
Yeah, I think this was the best, you know, that last week was, you know, the kind of put the best possible light on everything that's been done. I mean, I think that the light rail had one of its best moments. I mean, it was just packed all week, and it would stop at the Westin Hotel. People would get out, you know, right at the foot of the convention. But you can go back and look at some of the other ones where, Whitewater Center hosted some delegate parties. NASCAR Hall of Fame hosted some parties. They had kind of a smaller role in the convention. But, I think certainly light rail came out and the arena, obviously.
But I guess the question I'm asking is that there's been a lot of people over time talking about, well, we don't need this. We just leave Charlotte alone. We don't need this arena. We don't need this light rail. I'll get in my car and I'll drive where I want to go. But when you have all these pieces in place, when you see them as an individual, you can say, okay, we don't need that. But when you put them in together as an aggregate, does it justify itself because we can attract a convention like this? Would we have been able to in the absence of these things?
Well, I'm not sure that each individual piece by itself would, if it weren't here, would be a deal breaker. But when you put all of them together, and don't forget, in addition to the ones you've mentioned, we've also had a significant increase in the arts presence on Tryon Street, for those that haven't been down to that part of the...
I meant to mention the museum.
Yeah, which is significant when some of us have been here long enough that we have guests come here to visit us. We had no idea what to do with them for a day, and now we can keep them busy for 3 or 4 days.
We are an aspirational city. We really are looking at what do you do to top this, and I understand all that, but the DNC isn't an ending. It is a beginning for this city, it seems to me. But shouldn't that mean that we need to get a greater number of smaller events to come to this town so that we can use the facilities more consistently? Because you talk about, Steve, in the Observer, that the convention center is unused most of the time, 35% of the time, as opposed to other cities where it's used 57% of the time.
Yeah, the CRVA, which runs the convention center, hopes that they'll be able to parlay the DNC into bringing in more events. That remains to be seen. The problem is that there's so much competition to get even these small conventions. That just down the road, Nashville's opening up a new convention center. Raleigh just opened one a few years ago. So it's going to be hard to, even with the DNC, to bring in a lot of new business. Because at the end of the day, you know, the DNC may kind of, you know, a group may be interested and listen, but if another city gives them more money, then that's going to be the deal breaker.
I know we want to be world class. We have two professional sports teams, which didn't just happen by accident. We worked hard to get them, et cetera. But is there, from an economics point of view, is there something wrong with just being Charlotte, not trying to be world class, not trying to attract these A number one events like the Olympics, et cetera?
It's a really good question, and because it, you start to think about, well, what's different about Charlotte today than, say, 30 years ago before we had these aspirations? And I think the biggest difference is that for a lot of folks, there are now world-class job opportunities in Charlotte, and not just a few, lots of world-class job opportunities, if you will.
Meaning what? Because we're lagging the jobs situation.
Oh, I understand that, you know, we're in a cycle right now, yeah. But what I'm saying is that if you were to look at this community 30 years ago, the types of jobs that are now available at companies like Duke, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, in small companies that you've never heard of, like LendingTree, et cetera, all these little companies that have sprung up around here that are national firms with, you know, national reputations, and really high quality, high profile jobs. They didn't exist 30 years ago in this community. There are lots of them today. And so in terms of economic opportunity, cities like Charlotte, Atlanta, et cetera, offer a lot more than the next tier of cities, if you will, the Birminghams of the world.
I only have about a minute left here, but some say that it's urgent to get our debt under control, that we must do this or we're going to no longer be a great nation, we'll be a bankrupt nation. Others say we built the whole country on debt. Debt is a good thing. I think you said that under certain circumstances, debt is a good thing. So what's the real story here?
The real story, Mike, is that once you hit 100% debt to GDP, you're starting to get into some unique waters. And I'll just put it real quickly so everybody can understand. Right now, $16 trillion of debt, we're paying about 2% for that. It's costing us $320 billion a year to carry that debt. The debt tends to recycle about every 6 years, so you churn it and turn it over every 6 years. Think about this 12 years down the road. You've still got $16 trillion of debt, and instead of paying 2% on it, you're paying 6%. So instead of paying $300 billion a year in interest-carrying charges, you're now paying close to $1 trillion a year in interest-carrying charges in a $3 trillion budget. That's the problem that a big debt can have. That's what's going on in Italy right now. That's what's going on in Spain, because they are paying 6% rates to carry their debt.
Dr. John Connaughton, director of the Babson Capital UNC Charlotte Economic Forecast, and Steve Harrison, reporter for the Charlotte Observer, who did a lot of reporting on the impact of the DNC and other conventions on this city. Thanks for being here.